Hi, folks. My name is Dr. Amy Perlman. I'm a board-certified urologist with expertise in sexual, hormonal, and genitourinary health. And welcome to today's episode of Pearls and Perspectives. I have Dr. Diane Newman here with us today. Dr. Newman is a nurse practitioner with particular expertise in pelvic floor dysfunction and pelvic health. She is an adjunct professor of surgery at the Perelman School of Medicine with the University of Pennsylvania and has over 35 years of clinical experience. So she is going to talk to us today about pelvic floor dysfunction in men and women. Dr. Newman, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Dr. Perelman. Thanks so much for having me. And this is a really important topic to discuss. And I think I really commend you for, asking me to talk about it.
Absolutely. Now, you're a nurse practitioner. So how did you even get into the field of pelvic floor health to begin with?
Well, we have to go back many years to 1986. I was finishing up my master's in nurse practitioner certification at the University of Pennsylvania. And actually, a urologist from the suburbs of Philadelphia asked me to come practice with him because he was starting a continence center, treating mostly women. And I went and worked, practice with him. And right then it was just surgery. It was mostly for stress incontinence. And some of the women, not all of them, but some of them came back complaining of still having leakage or even some bladder problems. At that time, we used to call them voiding dysfunction. Now we call it overactive bladder. So I actually sought out what else I could do. And at that time, the Geriatric Research Center in Baltimore, part of the NIH, was studying biofeedback for fecal incontinence. And a well-known research scientist, Kathy Bergio, was there. And she was using biofeedback. And I just went down there and learned how to do it. And I brought it back to his practice. And actually, that started my career.
Wow.
That was actually a urologist who helped me. So it was really neat. Yeah. And I saw that by identifying the pelvic floor in these women and working with them, some of them got better. So we started a program of combining surgery and pelvic floor retraining, basically.
Wow. So how has the field of pelvic floor physical therapy evolved over the last several decades? Because even in training, and I didn't do training that long ago, it really wasn't something that was commonly discussed. Out of the, unless we were talking about, let's say, someone with bladder pain syndrome or someone, a guy who was after prostate cancer surgery, who was leaking urine. How is that field evolved?
Well, it actually, I think, was really growing in the 90s, 2000s and that, and really growing in urology practices. And I had to say that it's actually decreased there. And what we see mostly now in practice is referral to specialists like physical therapists. And it's really a shame because when you look at the evidence-based research in this area, working your pelvic floor, strengthening your pelvic floor helps during pregnancy, helps women during menopausal years with urgency and frequency, and then with aging. But the question is always, where does this, treatment fit? Does it fit in urology? Does it fit in gynecology? Does it fit in urogynecology? And I think that in some ways it's really plateaued and hasn't really been growing. A lot of the nurse researchers who looked at pelvic muscle training with bladder training really have retired. I hate to say they've gone out of practice. We talk about that all along because some of the original work was done by nurse researchers with Kathy Bergio. So it's really, that's a major question is where should this fit? When you go outside the United States, you have nurses and physical therapists doing this routinely in practice. We haven't seen that evolve to that degree here in the U.S.
So it's so interesting that you say that because I feel like for nearly all the patients that I see, I'm picking up on some degree of pelvic floor dysfunction. So in my mind, everyone who comes in to see me has pelvic floor dysfunction. So from what you're talking about, from your perspective, you're saying like the research has really stalled.
Yeah, the research has stalled because we've shown it's effective. Mm-hmm. The research around conservative treatments, which includes lifestyle changes such as, looking at your diet, cutting out caffeine, watching how much fluid intake you have, looking at bowel function because we know constipation, right, causes some of these low urinary tract symptoms, bladder training, and then pelvic floor muscle exercises should be, the evidence is there, they are effective. If you look at guidelines from around the world, they note that that's what should be tried first. They're non-invasive. They are effective for a percentage of both men and women, especially with the aging adult. But you're right. where does it fit? And that's, I think, been a problem all along. I was very active with a lot of nurse practitioners, PAs in urology who were really practicing this. But I don't know. I think that it's somewhat, urology has changed. And I think some of the problem, what I found even back in the 80s, was some of the symptoms are caused by surgical intervention, aren't they? And the thing is then, you know, I think a lot of people do not want to admit to the fact that, hey, we need a really combined program. You know, I have to commend Dr. Alan Wien, who you know very well, because he's the one that brought me into his practice at the University of Pennsylvania in 2000, because he really believed in the fact that we should be treating the whole patient, and that, yes, sometimes there's complications after interventions such as surgery, but hey, we have something that can really help you. So he was really, he knew this before his time. I mean, he was really the most supportive person I've had really in my career.
Yeah, I remember when he would give the presentation to people interviewing for the urology residency, and he would put up your picture and he would say, this is probably the most famous person on faculty at the University of Pennsylvania.
You know, Amy, you know, you brought that up, and it's really interesting because, you know, we had a dinner for Alan, at Sufu last year or year before, and so many residents we had came up to me and said, Diane, I wish I had spent more time with you because this is a lot of what I need to do in practice. And it's true. And I always think of urology as, you know, kind of an oxymoron. You have the surgical end of it, but you have the chronicity of an end of it, right? And pelvic problems such as urgency, frequency, incontinence, UTIs, a lot of these pelvic pain, right, are really chronic non-surgical problems, right? And I think that it's really a shame. There needs to be more emphasis on this because I feel I've always practiced with urologists. I really feel this condition, lower urinary tract symptoms, really belong in urology. I think you guys are the best people to really treat it. We have the best practice and the best techniques to treat these symptoms.
So I saw online that part of your area of expertise is helping people with continence when they're in long-term care facilities. And I feel like that's like the bane of our existence is like figuring out how to help those people. So what are some of the tools that maybe urologists are not aware of that could help that patient population or just the geriatric patient who has incontinence issues?
Well, you know, it really needs to be looking at especially the older adults or the geriatric patient. You really have to think about, you know, what is their living situation? What is their functional ability? Okay, because what the data has shown is that a lot of the hip fractures that we treat in the older adult is caused by rushing to the bathroom. You know, at nighttime, getting up and going to the bathroom and tripping on carpet, or, you know, even some people say they actually slipped on urine because they had an accident. So the thing is that we need to be more proactive, and it has to be part of geriatric care. But there's, again, a lot of things you can do. Functionality, how are they managing their problem? What is their most bothersome problem? What's really affecting them most? And then back to diet, and what you see in a lot of older adults is really bowel dysfunction, right? You see constipation because they tend to be on a lot of medications and they cause it. So there's a lot of things you can do with that individual. I did tell you that I kind of loved doing a telehealth during COVID because I saw their home and I saw where they lived and I saw, you know, what's going on with you at nighttime. Well, you know, where is the location of the bathroom during the day? My career has been somewhat unique in the fact that after I got my nurse practitioner and started with incontinence, I actually started a practice with other nurse practitioners because in 1989, Medicare now allowed nurse practitioners to go into long-term care nursing homes and be reimbursed for their services. Before that, there was nothing as far as reimbursement. It was always through a physician. And we actually went to nursing homes in southeastern Pennsylvania, actually Delaware and New Jersey, and worked with individuals. I can't tell you how much you can really see some improvement in those that may be more functional. So there's a lot you can do in that population. I also did home visits, and that was through a contract I had with the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, where we went into the home. What happens with elder care, and it's one of the programs I'm most, so happy that I did because it led to a lot of interventions that I then used in practice at Penn. But in Pennsylvania, the Area Office on Aging, Philadelphia Corporation on Aging, keeps elders in their home who qualify for nursing home care. It's supported actually through our lottery funds in Pennsylvania. And they found that they were having to give absorbent products to a large portion of these older adults in the county in Philadelphia. So I was kind of like the continence nurse. And I would go out and really do behavioral therapy. And what I did was I created, Amy, an audio cassette recording of bladder training and pelvic floor muscle exercises. And I would, you know, give that to them and have them practice that for twice a day. And it got to the point where even the Agency on Aging would buy the tape recorders for them back in the 90s. Okay, so that was tape recorders, right? I then went to pen, and a lot of my patients say, we don't use cassette tapes anymore, right? And these were audio. So I put it on a CD. And then about, I don't know, in the 2010s, a lot of my patients said, Diane, we don't have CDs and cards anymore. So I put them online. And actually, a lot of that work people can download now. And it's an MP3 file. And it's like, if you have stress incontinence, you just do the pelvic floor muscle exercises. If you have urgency with incontinence, I talk about how to do bladder training, and then you walk through exercises. And it's very simple. I just say, now we're going to do pelvic floor muscle exercises, and I count for them. Amy, I've used that throughout my practice. And now I tell patients, you know, download it. And I have clinicians who download that work. So I think that there's ways that you can really implement these educational, you know, interventions for the pelvic floor and make it easy for patients. It's not for everyone. You know that. There's a percentage of patients that are going to go on third line treatment. Maybe they need Botox. They may need neuromodulation. But really the evidence is to start with non-invasive lifestyle and retraining methods of the pelvic floor.
So I'm so glad that you mentioned that digital service that you have. So where can people find that? Because I know a big barrier for urologists is either our patient may not be open to seeing a pelvic physical therapist, you know, if it's out of pocket, maybe the expense, or maybe just the location, there's not someone close by or the access. So if we can direct patients to an online module to at least get our patients started, where can patients find that or providers find it?
Well, if you go online and you put in my name, Diane Newman, it comes up. But it's also on, it's called Awaken Pelvic Health. And it's a website and it's under resources. And there's a lot of resources there. And I'm also, because I'm now editor of Grand Rounds in Urology, we're actually creating a portal there. And that'll go out to urologists in general. But yes, you're right. It's whatever, you know, you can do to, it's kind of, you know, when you think of like other programs where you listen and follow those instructions, that's what it is. But there's also devices, but for women, not for men. And it's because women have vaginas, and we can, you know, the pelvic floor muscle surrounds that. And there's a lot of devices out there that have a biofeedback component. And I recommend those also to women. You know, I always say, if I had incontinence, say I have had three babies, okay, I've had three pregnancies. The data shows that one out of three women 6 months post-pregnancy has stress incontinence. If that was me, I would probably buy a device to learn how to rehab my pelvic floor. When you go outside the U.S., like in UK and England, if you have a baby, you get visited by a pelvic floor specialist and taught that that muscle has been damaged because the baby came through the vagina, the muscle has been stressed, maybe to different degrees, right, depending on the birth. You need to rehab it. Doesn't that make sense? And actually, they teach you how to do it. In France, women after pregnancy are sent to a practice like I have, Penn, where they are put on a treadmill and they're hooked up. So they either have a vaginal sensor or surface electrodes around the anus, and they watch a computer screen on the treadmill. And as they walk, they have to contract their pelvic floor, and they see that graph. Does that make sense? Again, because, hey, you need to rehab this area. We don't do that in the U.S., and that's really such a barrier and challenge. And, you know, I think women need to demand it.
Yeah.
You know, because you hear more about women, you hear celebrities after pregnancy, right, talking about they have incontinence, they're leaking, they have to wear a pad. So it's really something we need to get back before you have to go to that urologist, right? We need to look at it in women's health is what it should be, rehabbing your pelvic floor.
Yeah, it's so crazy because we often send patients to pelvic specialists who are as like last line therapy after we've tried all the medications and all the surgeries and they're still struggling, when really what you're saying and what I'm definitely saying is that it really should be first line therapy.
It really should be, and it should start the earlier in the woman's lifespan. You know, a lot of women I see, and men we tend to see right with aging or after doing something to their prostate. Okay. So we don't see that in men, but women have certain events throughout their life that affect them. Number one is childbirth. And we see it with either vaginal and even cesarean section. We see damage to the pelvic floor, and some women will have stress incontinence. Then we go through menopause, right? And we lose the estrogen hormone in the area of the bladder, urethra, the vagina, and that muscle's not as supported. So that's when actually I start to see women. You know, I see women like premenopausal, late 40s, in their 50s, and they start with urgency frequency. They start with overactive bladder. They may not have urgency incontinence yet, but they're finding they're always in the bathroom. And I see that in certain profession, teachers, those women in retail, and they come in because they're like, oh, I don't know what's happening here. Some of them may have had also stress incontinence that they've lived with. Not a big deal, episodic, right? Doesn't always happen. But then urgency frequency, they're in the bathroom, they're worried they're not going to make it. And then with aging, so women have life events that actually puts them more at risk. So you're right, these should be started earlier in life, since we know that there's a percentage of women are going to develop these symptoms.
You mentioned the use of technology and devices. Are there any ones in particular that you recommend? And if someone is looking online, how would they determine what a good device is? And is there a price range that they should be looking at?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's a lot of different devices out there. And actually, the one that we're actually using in one of our research for the I'm part of the Pelvic Floor Dysfunction Network, which has been funded through several cycles. I'm a co-investigator on that network. We're doing a study now in women 6 months post-pregnancy, and we're comparing pelvic floor muscle exercises with just instructions, pelvic floor are more intense, and then we're using a device called the Leva. It was developed by a urogynecologist. And it is a biofeedback device, and it has some counseling support. So I do recommend that. There's another one out there that uses electrical stimulation that was actually developed by a physical therapist, I believe, in England. And it's almost like a Spanx, you know, that almost like you put it on and it stimulates the pelvic area. I've had some success with that. So they are out there. What I caution women when they look for these devices, is there any research like this? Quite a bit of research on Leva. There's research on this other device. How is it used? So investigate a little bit. But I say to people, it's almost like you go to the gym and use weights, right? So you use some type of device or technology, right? You know that in your practice for erectile dysfunction. You need a complement what you're doing with maybe something that will help you understand what you're doing and make sure that you're achieving like a pelvic floor muscle contraction. So I still recommend these devices. Some women come to me and have already found them. If you go back to vaginal weights, Benoit balls, that are an Asian type of rape product, you know, people laugh about that, but really there's some research that was done back in the 80s and 90s for weights. And the concept was you went from no weight, it was like a tampon, right? No weight you put in your vagina, and you contracted the pelvic floor to retain it up to a heavier weight. So you would progress per weight. That data showed that they tested that in women in England waiting for surgery because with their socialized system, they may wait several months. That a third of those women did not go into surgery because their symptoms resolved. I mean, so that makes sense, doesn't it? So I say there's thinking about technology, you use it so much. There is a need maybe in some women for some technology out there. And you can find these devices on the internet. I tend to recommend more the ones that have a vaginal sensor. When you go back, we talk about pelvic floor muscle exercise and rehabilitation. Probably 99.9% of women who come to me, not men, but women, tell me they've been doing Kegels. And whenever I do an exam, and I always do an exam, and I test the pelvic floor visually with a finger or two, or I sometimes use a speculum, they're not isolating their muscle. And the data has shown that. We don't know whether maybe through pregnancy, loss of estrogen, aging, we don't have as much sensation in that area of the pelvis, the bladder, the urethra, the vagina, right? And the problem is that they don't understand how to isolate it. And I find this in young and old, sexually active women and older women also. And the thing is, if you don't isolate it, then you don't contract the correct muscle. And that's why these devices also may help.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, like when I'm contracting my pelvic floor, I'm contracting like the muscles around, like the posterior ones around my rectum.
Right.
It is hard to contract the ones around the vagina. And I think that's what we also see in men after prostate surgeries. We oftentimes tell them, well, try to cut off your urinary stream or start doing Kegels. And what they're doing is they're strengthening their posterior muscles. So are there better cues verbally? You've done a lot of work in the audio space. What are those cues that you're telling both men and women to contract the appropriate muscles that are controlling urination?
Well, you brought up again, contracting your, when you say I contract my rectum, I feel that that's the posterior. So that's the back of the muscle. I give them a couple things. So they're sexually active. Okay. And they have vaginal intercourse. Their partner should feel contraction around the penis. So I do talk to women about that. And for younger women, that makes sense. You could put your finger in your vagina, again, for women, and contract the muscle. You should feel compression around your finger. The pelvic floor muscle is found 1 inch intravaginally, okay? It surrounds, it's attached to the pelvic bone, and it's like a sling. It goes around the urethra of the vagina and slings around the rectum and comes back around the other side, okay? It's a supportive structure. In Chinese literature, they really believe that's the energy in the body, is in the pelvic floor, they call it. It's called the pelvic floor because it's in the floor of the pelvis, okay? That's as simple as it is. With women, we have a longer length span of that muscle because it surrounds the urethra, the vagina, and the rectum. In men, it's only the urethra at the level of the prostate and around the rectum. So men tend to have increased sensation. Another way I tell them to both men and women is, say you're in an elevator or a room full of people or someone's next to you and you feel like you're going to pass gas. You don't want to embarrass yourself, okay? You know, if it's a difference. So what you do is you tighten your rectum, right? And try to suppress it. Well, that's the pelvic floor muscle. So you're right. Sometimes I just work posteriorly to the muscle because in time you can pull the entire muscle anteriorly in the front. Now, a lot of, you brought up in point, just stop and start to stream of urine. So the concept is since the pelvic floor muscle surrounds the urethra, if you're urinating, right, and you contract that muscle, the urine should stop, right, because you're squeezing that urethra. But in women, now remember, women have short urethras. Men have longer ones because it goes through the penis, right? Well, they've shown in some studies is that when women contracted that, it refluxed the urine back up into the system, the renal system. So that's not looked on as, I don't really teach that initially. As the woman gets stronger, I say, have you been able to do that? But a lot of women cannot start and stop their stream of urine. Men tend to be much better at that. So then they get frustrated. So I give them these other cues of how to do it. But really, if you're sitting, if a woman's sitting, they should feel, like you said, the rectum pull in, but also the vagina pull up, okay? Men, their penis may move because, again, they're contracting around the urethra. So it's hard, though. If you read Kegel's work, I always, when I lecture, talk to other providers about this who are learning this. Dr. Kegel, was an obstetrician gynecologist in Southern California in the 1950s. He published in the New England Journal of Medicine, you can find his articles, randomized controlled trials. He noticed that women with what he called relaxed vaginas were leaking urine. And he developed what he called an isometric contraction of the pelvic floor. That's a Kegel. But he had a specialized clinic. He had a specialized nurse. And the saying is he had a device. He had a biofeedback device, what we just talked about. And the story is that he made it in his garage. It was a pressure device that went in the vagina, hooked to tubing into a tire gauge. So as the woman contracted around this pressure, you know, the pressure went up and the numbers went up as she got stronger. And that became, in medicine, just go and, you know, tighten that muscle down there. And it, you know, verbal instructions. And that's why I say you need to do a little bit more. Start with your exam. Can a woman feel your finger in the vagina? Does the man feel a finger in the rectum? Can they contract around your finger? And then say, now that's how you do it. So it needs a little bit more for identification by that practitioner.
Yeah. You know, I've seen many times in an after visit summary when we're sending someone out after prostate surgery and we give them brief instructions on how to do strengthening exercises. That doesn't seem like enough.
No, and you know, if you look at the data, Kathy Bergio did it, is that you need to start it before surgery, before they have trauma to that area. And that she did it, and she showed men who started doing pelvic floor muscular exercises pre-prostatectomy surgery or pre-even radiation or, you know, proton therapy, whatever they were having, they got drier quicker. So the issue is, it's probably better to start working the muscle when you don't have any trauma to it. That's why I say we should start younger. I really believe that it should be in school. We teach sex education. We talk about not smoking. We should talk about the bladder. I've never been able to get that into school nurses and as part of health classes. I've had teachers tell me it's too sensitive of a subject. And, you know, you're in sexual health. I mean, to me, I would think that's a little bit more sensitive, you know. But yeah, and also, since it's related to constipation, which is a problem in younger children and women, you know, that there's really healthy things we could be teaching them. So the goal should be is we should be doing this prior to pregnancy and all those effects that happen, right? But I don't know. We just don't see it moved. And I don't know if maybe because women are predominantly the population that we see it in younger years. I don't know if it's because all the advertisement for absorbent products, which is a very big business, right? You have a pad for every type of leakage that you have, right? You can hide it. So I don't know. I mean, it's kind of a little frustrating to me because I've been in my career for so many years that I don't really think we've advanced. We've gotten better medications. We've gotten better maybe interventions like neuromodulation and better surgical procedures. But, you know, we're still just attacking the problem once it occurs, right? When maybe we need to, you know, look at it as far as earlier in that life cycle for both men and women, it should be really part of health. So hopefully at some point we'll get to that.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I think a big issue is who's going to teach that course on bowel and bladder, right, in the schools, because the people that are teaching it are the ones who show up in our clinics and they're struggling and they've never been taught about it either. You know, I think about when I ask whose role is it to teach young men about their health? And I ask, is it the pediatrician's role? Is it the dad's role, the mom's role, the physical education teacher's role? Like, whose job is it? And everyone has a different response. But the reality is none of those people have been taught the basics. So why would they be teaching young men, you know, or young boys about it? It's crazy.
I had a recent conversation with a co-investigator of mine who's an obstetrician gynecologist. I won't say her name. But her daughter is a gymnast, and I see her a lot on Facebook. And she showed me a meme from one of the top gymnasts, and I don't remember the name, that a certain flip, backward flip, they leak. And it's only that one. And think about the force on the pelvic floor. So we're seeing it in athletes. And I was talking to her because she's now she's in charge of medical education. And I said to her, do you ask about this? And she was part of our research from years, and she looked at me and said, I don't think we are, but she thinks she can make an impact in that. And literally, she was on her phone saying to the person she's working with, what is our intake form like? But it's coming out in athletes, young girls. The data's out there that certain sports that has force on the pelvic floor may cause you to leak. Now, does that mean you have a weak pelvic floor or not? Not necessarily. It's the force is so great from, you know, that jumping, those gymnasts, you see how what they do with their body, right? And I said to her, well, then we need to pick that up, because should her pregnancy care differ if you start with the problems, right? I mean, you know, is that someone that we should say, oh, you need to really start this because having that baby, you know what I mean, may put you at further risk. That needs to be when we start, because we know that their women are now, they're, you know, more, they're in competitive sports, they're in jobs, right? Which, you know, construction jobs, lifting and that type of thing. That it's not that it's so abnormal to not develop some of these bladder symptoms, but what we need to do is identify them and then work with that individual, right, at that point. And so that we don't end up with, like, we had a little discussion about that 80-year-old woman in the nursing home, right? that she's learned what to do, you know, 60 years prior type of thing. So, you know, I hope in time that, you know, in some ways the emphasis on health might help us, right? Because we're talking about getting a healthy pelvis, right? A healthy pelvic floor throughout your life.
I want to pick your brain a little bit on just at-home devices outside of ones that are specifically, you know, for biofeedback, but just easy devices people could get at home. So do you recommend, like, can tennis balls be helpful? Do you recommend certain pelvic wands, dilators? So, you know, what are the things you recommend for both men and women?
Yeah, I for women, I do recommend sometimes dilators, especially if they have issues with high tone. We talked about pelvic floor muscle weakness, but there's some women that the pelvic floor is so contracted that it causes pain. They cannot relax with intercourse, right? I have men who develop pelvic pain in stressful jobs, believe it or not. I always tell a story about a guy that after 9/11 was always listening to terrorist chatter all day long. He was in the military. He came to me with such pelvic pain. And, you know, and I talked with him about what his occupation was. And you can imagine the stress, you know, watching the computer and that. And sitting, we sit on our pelvic floor. So sometimes dilators will work for pelvic pain. And actually, there's actually something called an anal wand that you can get for men that have really severe pain that's more, they tend to have it. And we treat, of course, we treat them rectally. And it really helps them with relaxation. So, yes, I do recommend that. As far as balls, I mean, you know, you want to, you can get them online. I mean, there are, you know, I think that actually Goop had something out there as far as a device in stores that, you know, if I have Asian products, you can find Benwon balls. And what they are is just weights. They're round balls, they're weights. And the concept is you put them in the vagina and tighten, you know, some of the sex toys are work too, as far as for women. Men, it's more difficult because it has to go in the rectum, right? And not all men will do that. So, you know, it's difficult to get to their pelvic floor, you know, especially, say, after having some type of prostate procedure and they develop some symptoms.
So should all these people that might be interested in different tools, you know, using them at home, should they see a pelvic specialist first? Or is it okay for them to try these different tools at home and see how they do with them?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think it really depends on the age of the individual and when the symptoms developed and why. I really hate to say you should all try this at home without seeing someone, because we know that these symptoms were underreported. The research shows that women on average wait 3 years before reporting this. Most of the patients I see that are women will tell me, I've had this for years. Now it's worse. Oh, I used to have the leak with a cough. That was not a big deal. That happened all the time. But now I'm running to the bathroom. Men come in right away. And I don't know if that's because, you know, men don't have the life course events that women do. It's usually a procedure. Something, you know, may have caused that. Or it could be secondary to aging, but they will not put up with it. We don't quite understand why women do. So when you say, well, should they just go online and maybe purchase something? You know, I think it really depends. If I was a woman who just had a baby, I was so concerned because I'm thinking, I think that's probably very safe, okay? But they should talk to their primary care doctor about it. You know, the problem is that the primary care doctor may not know a lot about this. That's the thing. Or their gynecologist, right? They should bring it up. I think the most important thing is bring it up. They may not want to do the treatment that's recommended and they do something themselves at home. That's fine. But they really should talk to someone you know, about their symptoms to make sure that they're getting proper advice.
So my last question is this. What do you think the remaining research questions are when it comes to pelvic health? Like, what are you trying to answer?
Well, one of the things I think, Amy, that a lot of these bladder symptoms, urgency, frequency, overactive bladder symptoms can be done through telehealth. I think that, you know, they may not require that visit per se. And I think that I changed my whole views during COVID because of the telehealth thing and listening to individuals about their symptoms and actually seeing their environment. So I do think that that's what we're going to see more in the future. I think we're going to see more counseling over the phone. One of the studies that I'm finishing up, and I know that we've gone on long, but this is a really exciting, this to me is an exciting study. I want to tell you about this. About and during COVID, a VP from a medical supply company in Dallas, Texas, approached me. She had done a pilot study. Now, they give absorbent products to Medicare Advantage, Medicaid disabled individuals. That's part of the plan. So that's who will get them. We're talking about these plans can spend millions of dollars on these products because of the prevalence of incontinence, right? She had put in a counseling service. She trained her staff to talk to them about their diet, toileting, their bowels, their fluid intake, their skin care. With one call and the second call that month, she called them twice a month, was what product are you using? She saved the insurer money and decreased their pad use. By decreasing the pad use. We then designed a study with researchers from the University of Minnesota. It was IRB approved. It was exempt through Penn, University of Pennsylvania. And we actually worked with a Medicare Advantage insurer out of Ohio. And we tracked falls, UTIs, and pressure ulcers, because those are things that can happen, right, if you have incontinence. We also tracked their product use. We created a program with those. First call was to talk about one of those conservative treatments, right? You know, how's your bowels? What are you doing for it? You know, how are you drinking? The second call of the month is, what pad are you using? Is that the right pad? Or are you using Kleenex with it? Or are you double padding? Because those are costs. I submitted an abstract because we now have the data. We actually decreased pad use and we decreased their incontinence. And these are pretty high-risk disabled individuals, okay? So, you know, this can be done. And maybe that's what's going to happen, because there are costs for this. There are medical costs that insurers are paying. So perhaps that may become more mainstream. So that's what I see in the future. I see more of that type of counseling and work through telehealth, through other programs of counseling that I think that we're going to start to be seeing in the future.
Wow, that's awesome. Now, let me just ask you one follow-up question. When you're meeting with these folks who have disabilities, are you meeting with them and or their caretakers? Who is on the receiving end of the call?
Yeah, it's interesting. We track that and we ask, is there someone else on the line? So we say, is it the actual individual who's insured, right? And we ask those questions. Do you have a caregiver? Are they on the line also? So yeah, sometimes it is the caregiver, because some of what you say, like for instance, the diet, the caregiver may be the one, you know, buying you coffee, tea, or whatever, you know, some of the irritants. So we do involve them in there. So you're right. And you can see, I'm sure you're already thinking this can be applied to a lot of different settings, right? Where you do have a caregiving, because we have an aging population. And, you know, we're going to see more and more care at home. So there's a lot of things that can be implemented with the assistance of a caregiver to really help that individual live independently at home and not develop a problem such as falls and that type of thing.
Dr. Newman, I'm starting this new thing where I want to give my guests like a megaphone. What's the message? If I could give you a megaphone right now, what's the message that you would want to give to urologists? Let's say all the urologists are listening. What do you want to tell them?
Well, I tell them that they have to ask individuals about lower urinary tract symptoms, but also what do they want to do? Do they want to try with something simpler? What is their goal? Because they really need to think about some conservative, non-invasive treatments, because these things do work. And you will be astounded how many individuals where you just track how much coffee they're drinking and say to them, hey, can we cut down that by 50%? They come back and say, oh, you know what? It's a little bit better. And that's such a simple thing, Amy, but it does work in a percentage of patients. So asking them about their lifestyle, you know, what they're doing, what they're drinking, all that can make a really big impact.
Awesome. That's a great message and something that doesn't cost any money. And maybe just 10 seconds of time. It doesn't.
Right.
We don't have to tackle every lifestyle factor.
No.
It might just be the coffee during one visit.
Or, you know, how many times do you have somebody come in with a bottle of water or a container of water, right? Especially the younger generation. Okay. How many of those do you drink a day? Mm-hmm. You know, do you see that correlate? So, yes, you're right. Sometimes it's a simple thing that you can start, you know, a discussion about this.
I love that. Dr. Newman, thank you so much for joining us today on today's Pearls and Perspectives episode.
Thanks a lot for having me.